And today he's determined to come to the rescue before a certain set of pearls go astray. The story is read by Julian Ryan Tutt.
The American drained his cocktail.
"Captain Hugh Drummond of Half Moon Street, London, is your man," he said. "That's the message I received from the States. Well, Captain, what about it? Will you tell me why you've come to Paris? I guess it's something to do with the business I'm on."
"Look at the gentleman opposite," said Hugh. "The one hitting his knee with his left hand. That is why I came to Paris. Why, is he kind of friendly with Hiram C. Potts?"
"The first time I met Mr. Potts," said Drummond, "that Frenchman had just put a thumbscrew on him. That was when I removed your millionaire. I should put that gentleman down as a sort of super-criminal. I wonder what name he is passing under here."
"Why, do they vary?"
"Well, in England, he's clean-shaven, possesses a daughter, and answers to Carl Peterson."
"Possesses a daughter?"
For the first time, the detective displayed traces of excitement.
"Holy smoke, it can't be him. Look, he's going into the restaurant. What is he doing here, dining with Hawking, our cotton trust man? And that's Steinman, isn't it? The German coal man? That other guy's face is familiar. I can't quite place his name. Two of them, at any rate, Captain, have got more millions than we're ever likely to have thousands."
Hugh stared at the American. "Last night, he was foregathering with a crowd of the most atrocious revolutionaries it's ever been my luck to run up against." The detective slapped his leg.
"I'll eat my hat if that Frenchman isn't Franklin or Libstein or Baron de Rat or any other of the blamed names he calls himself.
He's the biggest proposition we've ever been up against, and he's done us every time. He always covers his tracks. He's a genius. Gee, if we could only lay him by the heels."
"Excuse me a moment," said Hugh.
"Waiter!"
A man who had been hovering round came up promptly.
"Four of them, Ted," said Hugh. "Frenchman with a beard, a Yank, and two Boches. Do your best."
"Right, I will, Bean," said the waiter, and disappeared unobtrusively into the restaurant.
The American was staring at him in amazement.
"Who the devil is that guy?"
"Ted Jerningham, son of Sir Patrick Jerningham, Bart, of Jerningham Hall, Rutland, England.
Incidentally, your friend Mr. Potts is at present tucked between the sheets in that very house. He went there by aeroplane this morning."
He waved a hand towards Jerry. He was the pilot.
The American was shaking his head a little dazedly.
"If you and your pals, Captain, are ever out of a job, the New York police is yours for the asking."
He thought for a moment.
"Revolutionaries last night, international financiers this evening. Why, the broad outline of the plan is as plain as the nose on your face. Quite a number of people in this world would benefit if England became a sort of second Russia. It would be worth paying through the nose for such a thing. Of course, it would have to be done properly. A series of small strikes would be useless. It would have to be one gigantic general strike all over your country. And that is what Peterson's playing for.
I'll stake my bottom dollar.
He's in with the big financiers, and he's using the tub-thumping Bolshies as tools."
"And where the devil does Potts come in?" said Hugh.
"And the Duchess of Lampshire's pearls."
"Pearls?"
began the American, when the restaurant door opened suddenly and Ted Jerningham emerged, followed, with miraculous rapidity, by a crowd of infuriated head waiters. He advanced, while his entourage, torn between rage at his effrontery and horror at the thought of a scene, followed in his wake. Just opposite Hugh, he halted, and in a clear voice addressed no one in particular.
"You're spotted. Look out. Ledger at Godalming."
Then, engulfed once more in the crowd, he disappeared from view.
"The ledger at Godalming," said Hugh.
"Last night I watched Peterson through the skylight with that volume.
I'm thinking, Mr. Green, we'll have to look inside that ledger." It was the Comte de Guy who boarded the boat express at the Gare du Nord the next day.
It was Carl Peterson who stepped off the boat express at Boulogne. And it was only Drummond's positive assurance which convinced the American that the two characters were the same man.
Peterson was leaning over the side of the boat reading a telegram when he first saw Hugh 10 minutes after the boat had left the harbour. He waved a cheerful greeting.
"This is a pleasant surprise," he remarked. "Have you been to Paris too?"
Drummond looked at him. Was the man so sure of his power of disguise that he assumed he hadn't been recognised?
And it suddenly struck Hugh that, save for the one habit of striking his knee with his left hand, which in all probability Peterson himself was unconscious of, he would probably not have recognised him.
"Yes," said Drummond. "Came over to see how you behaved yourself."
"What a pity I didn't know," said Peterson, carefully tearing the telegram into tiny pieces and dropping them overboard. "We might have had another of our homely little chats over some supper. Where did you stay?"
"At the Ritz. And you?"
"I always stop at the Bristol," answered Peterson. "Quieter than the Ritz, I think."
"Yes, it was quite dreadful last night," said Hugh. "A pal of mine, quite incorrigible, that bird over there," he pointed to Ted Jerningham, "insisted on dressing up as a waiter. Not content with that, he went and dropped the fish over some warrior's boiled shirt and had to leave in disgrace."
He selected a cigarette.
"No accounting for this dressing up craze, is there, Carl? You'd never be anything but your own sweet self, would you?"
He looked thoughtfully at Peterson.
"I see you've thrown away your cigar, Carl. Can it be... oh, surely not... that you're feeling icky boo? Face going green, collar tight?"
A few minutes later, Jerningham and the American found him leaning against the rails, still laughing.
"What's happened?" asked Jerningham. "It's happening," said Drummond. "Peterson has been overcome by the waves. Our little Carl is busy recalling his past."
But even in the midst of his agony, Peterson was consoled by one reflection. "Should it be necessary, letter awaits him."
So had run the telegram, which he had scattered to the winds right under Drummond's nose.
And it was necessary.
"Walk right in, Mr. Green," said Hugh, as 3 hours later they got out of a taxi in Half Moon Street. "This is my little rabbit hutch."
He followed the American up the stairs and produced his latchkey.
But before he could insert it, the door was flung open, and Peter Durrell stood facing him with evident relief in his face. "Thank the Lord you've come, old son. There's something going down at Godalming." He followed Hugh into the sitting room. "At 12 o'clock today, Toby rang up. He was talking away when suddenly he stopped short and said, 'My God, what do you want?' Then there was the sound of a scuffle. I heard Toby curse, and then nothing more. I rang and rang, no answer."
"What do you do?"
said Drummond, a letter in his hand which he had taken off the mantelpiece.
"Algy was here. He drove straight off to see if he could find out what was wrong. I stopped here to tell you."
Hugh said nothing. He was reading the letter. It was short and to the point.
"When did this come?"
he said.
"An hour ago."
"Denny,"
he shouted,
"I want my car round at once."
He looked at the two men.
"If they've hurt one hair of her head, I'll murder that gang one by one with my bare hands."
"May I see this letter?" said the American. He read out,
"For pity's sake, come at once. The bearer of this is trustworthy."
He looked up.
"It's my fiancée's writing," said Hugh.
"Are you certain?" said the detective. "There is such a thing as forgery. A girl in real trouble wouldn't put in that bit about the bearer."
"I'm going to Godalming," said Hugh.
"Well, if you go," said the detective, "I come too."
"And me," said Peter.
Hugh grinned.
"Not you, old son. If Mr. Green will come, I'll be delighted, but I want you here at headquarters." They did the trip in well under the hour. Drummond parked and dodged rapidly through the bushes. When the American finally overtook him, he was standing by a side door, knocking hard.
"Seems kind of empty," said the detective.
"Why not try the front door?"
"Because it's inside of the other house," said Hugh. "I'm going to break in."
He retreated a yard from the door, then, bracing his shoulder, he charged it. Rapidly, the two men went from room to room. Every one was empty. Finally, only the dining room remained. And as they stood by the door looking round, the American shifted his third piece of gum to a new point of vantage.
Looks like a boozing den after a thick night.
Hugh took in the disorder. The tablecloth was pulled off, the telephone lay on the floor, china and glass smashed to pieces littered the carpet. He suddenly stepped forward and picked up a plain circle of glass with a black cord attached to it through a small hole.
Algy Longworth's eyeglass, he muttered. So he's been caught too.
At that moment, clear and distinct through the still evening air, came a woman's agonized scream from the house next door. The American watched Drummond, running like a stag, cross the lawn and disappear in the trees. For a second he hesitated, then he rapidly left the house by the way they had entered. Drummond had yielded to impulse. Subconsciously, he had known that he was deliberately putting his head into what, in all probability, was a carefully prepared noose. But when a girl shrieks, and the man who loves her hears it, arguments begin to look tired. And what little caution might have remained completely vanished as Hugh saw the girl watching him with agonized terror in her face from an upstairs window as he dashed up to the house.
I'm coming, darling!
He had given one wild shout and hurled himself through the door. A dazzling light had shone in his face, momentarily blinding him. Then had come a crushing blow on the back of his head, and Hugh Drummond, dimly conscious of men all around him, had pitched forward on his face into utter oblivion.
It's too easy, said Lackington.
So you have thought before, Henry, said Peterson, and he always bobs up again. If you take my advice, you'll finish him off here and now and run no further risks.
Kill him while he's unconscious? No, Carl, not under any circumstances. He has quite a lengthy score to pay, and by God, he's going to pay it this time.
Lash him up like the other two, said Lackington,
and leave him to cool until I get back tomorrow.
He turned to two of the men standing near. Carry him to the central room. Another of you get the rope. And so it was that Algy Longworth and Toby Sinclair, swathed in rope and with fury in their hearts, watched the limp form of their leader being carried in. They sat and watched the same process being performed on Drummond.
Have you finished? Said Lackington.
The rope artist bestowed a final touch to the last knot and surveyed his handiwork.
Cold mutton would be lively compared to him when he wakes up.
Good. Then we'll bring him to.
Lackington took some crystals from a jar on one of the shelves and placed them in a tumbler. Then he added a few drops of liquid and held the glass directly under the unconscious man's nose. In less than a minute, Drummond opened his eyes and stared dazedly round the room. He blinked as he saw Longworth and Sinclair. Then he looked down and found he was similarly bound.
Feeling better, my friend.
Lackington laid the tumbler on a table close by and turned to a man standing near the door.
My compliments to Miss Benton and ask her to be good enough to come down.
She came almost at once, a villainous-looking blackguard with her, and as she saw Hugh, she held out her hand to him.
Why did you come? Didn't you know it was only a forgery, that note?
If a charming girl is unwilling to write to her fiancé, said Lackington, her father is a very suitable person to supply the deficiency, especially if he has been kindly endowed by nature with a special aptitude for imitating writing.
Mr. Benton, who had been standing outside the door, came lurching into the room.
Quite right, Lackington, he announced. Dreadful thing to separate two young people.
Then he saw Drummond.
Was he all tied up for leather?
His voice tailed off and he collapsed gracefully in a heap on the floor. Phyllis turned on Lackington.
It's your doing entirely that he's in that condition.
Lackington smiled.
When we're married, we'll put him into a really good home for inebriates.
Married, she whispered. I'd kill myself before I married you.
Lackington glanced at his watch.
Time presses, and I don't want to go without telling you a little about the programme, Captain Drummond.
Unfortunately, both Mr. Peterson and I have to leave you for tonight.
Tomorrow, when I return, I propose to try a few experiments on you, and though I fear you will find them painful, it is a great thing to suffer in the cause of science. You will always have the satisfaction of knowing that dear little Phyllis will be well cared for.
With a sudden movement, he seized the girl and kissed her before she realised his intention. The rope round Drummond creaked as he struggled impotently. A rain of blows came down on Drummond's face till, with a gasping sigh, the girl slipped fainting to the floor.
"That'll do, Lackington," said Peterson. "Have the girl carried upstairs and send for Heinrich. It's time we were off."
Lackington turned as the German came into the room. "Now leave them to you, Heinrich. Use the dog whip if they shout and gag them."
"They will not shout twice," said the German.
Slowly the hours dragged on until the last gleams of daylight had faded from the skylight above, and a solitary electric light hung centrally gave the only illumination. At length Heinrich appeared carrying a tray with bread and water on it, which he placed on a table near Hugh. With a quiet smile, Hugh looked up at the German.
"How much, my friend, are you getting for this?"
The German leered at him.
"Enough to see that you tomorrow are here."
"And I always believed that yours was a business nation," said Hugh.
"Why, you poor fool, I've got £1,000 in notes in my cigarette case." For a moment, the German stared at him. Then a look of greed came into his pig eyes.
"You'll have to undo one of the ropes, my friend, before you can get at it," said Hugh.
For a moment, the German hesitated. He looked at the ropes. The one that bound the arms and the upper part of the body was separate from the rope round the legs. Even if he did undo it, the fool Englishman was still helpless, and he knew that he was unarmed. What risk was there after all? He went behind the chair, and Hugh felt him fumbling with the rope.
"You'd better be careful, Heinrich, that none of your comrades see, or you might have to share."
The German grunted. The English swine had moments of brightness. He went over and closed the door. Then he resumed untying the rope. At last it fell clear, and the German sprang back. Hugh extracted the case and held it in one hand.
"Put the case on the table," cried the German.
"Certainly not," said Hugh. "Until you undo my legs, then you shall have it."
"First eyes and notes must have."
The German was creeping nearer and nearer to the back of the chair.
"Then I your legs undo, and you may go."
Algy's warning cry rang out simultaneously with the lightning dart of the Boche's hand as he snatched at the cigarette case over Drummond's shoulder. It was the move he had been hoping for, and the German's wrist was held fast in his vice-like grip. Slowly, inexorably, the German was pulled over Drummond's shoulder until he grabbed the man's neck with his other hand. The end came quite suddenly. With one dreadful, convulsive heave, the German fell doubled up on the floor and lay still. Within a few minutes, all three were free. "Let's get the door open," said Algy, "and explore." Cautiously, they swung it open. The hall was deserted. They crept forward. Suddenly, Drummond, who was in front of the other two, stopped with a warning hiss. A light was streaming out from under a door at the end of a passage, and as they stood watching it, they heard a man's voice coming from the same room. Someone else answered him, and then there was silence once more. At length, Hugh moved forward again, and the others followed. It was not until they got quite close to the door that a strange, continuous noise began to be noticeable. It rose and fell with monotonous regularity. Occasionally it was punctuated with a strangled snort.
"Great Scott," muttered Hugh. "The whole boiling are asleep or I'll eat my hat."
"Then who was it that spoke?" said Algy.
As if in answer to his question, there came the voice again from inside the room.
Well, Mr. Darrell, I guess we can pass on and leave this bunch.
With a laugh of joyful amazement, Hugh flung open the door and found himself looking from the range of a yard into two revolvers.
I don't know how you've done it, boys, he said, but you can put those guns away. I hate looking at them from that end.
He glanced round the room and a grin spread over his face. There were some 20 of the gang, all of them fast asleep. They sprawled grotesquely over the table. They lolled in chairs. They lay on the floor. They huddled in corners. And without exception, they snored and snorted.
A dandy bunch, remarked the American. Say now, Captain, we got a lorry load of the boys outside. Your friend here thought we'd better bring them along, so it's up to you to get busy.
Darrell saw the look of mystification on Hugh's face.
Mullings and his crowd, he said. When Mr. Green got back and told me you'd shoved your great mutton head in it again, thought I'd better bring the whole outfit.
Though you daisy,
cried Hugh, rubbing his hands together.
The Philistines are delivered into our hands. Get the boys in, Peter, and get these lumps of meat carted out to the lorry. And while you do that, we'll go upstairs and mop up. What's the fifth step?
But the murderous implement was not in use, and they passed up the stairs in safety. As they reached the top, a door opposite opened, and the man who had been guarding Phyllis Benton peered out suspiciously. His jaw fell as he saw the four men in front of him. Before he realised it, the American's revolver was within an inch of his head.
Keep quite still, son, or I guess it might sort of go off.
Hugh stepped past him, smiling at the girl who, with a joyful cry, had risen from her chair.
Your face, old boy, she whispered as he took her in his arms. Your poor old face.
Hugh grinned.
It's something to know that anything could damage it, old thing. Personally, I've always thought that any change must be for the better.
For a moment, she clung to him.
Where's your father?
He asked after a little pause.
In the dining room, I think.
Algy, take Miss Benton and her father up to Half Moon Street at once, then come back here.
He drew Longworth aside. You'll have a bit of a job with the old man. Get a couple of the boys to give you a hand.
He turned to the cowering ruffian, who was by this time shaking with fright. Now, you ugly-looking blighter, how many of these rooms up here are occupied, and which?
It appeared that only one was occupied, and at that moment its door was flung open and a thin, weedy object clad in a flannel nightgown stood on the threshold. Hugh extended an arm and pulled him into the passage.
This is an outrage, he cried.
Your legs undoubtedly are, remarked Hugh. Put on some trousers and get a move on. Now, you,
he turned to the other man.
When does Lackington return?
Tomorrow, sir.
Where is he now?
The man hesitated for a moment, but the look in Hugh's eyes galvanised him into speech.
He's after the old woman's pearls, sir, the Duchess of Lampshire's.
Of course he is, said Hugh. I forgot. And when does Peterson come back?
Tomorrow too, sir, as far as I know,
answered the man, and at that the weedy object shot rapidly out of his room.
And what's he doing? Demanded Drummond.
On the level, Governor, I can't tell you.
He can.
The man pointed to the latest arrival, who, with his nightgown tucked into his trousers, stood gasping painfully after the manner of a recently landed fish. Hugh turned to the American.
This is one of the Revolutionary Brigade I spoke to you about.
For a while, the three men studied him in silence. Then the American thoughtfully transferred his chewing gum to a fresh place.
He looks like some kind of disease, but I guess he's got a tongue.
Say, flop ears, what are you anyway?
I am the secretary of a social organization which aims at the amelioration of the conditions under which the workers of the world slave.
You don't say, remarked the American, unmoved.
What do you know about Peterson, little man? Said Hugh.
Nothing, save that he is the man we have been looking for years. A man of stupendous organizing power who has brought together and welded into one the hundreds of societies similar to mine. Now, we are combined, and our strength is due to him.
Hugh exchanged glances with the American.
Tell me, little man, now that you're all welded together, what do you propose to do?
That you shall see in good time. Constitutional methods have failed. And besides, we've got no time to wait for them. Millions are groaning under the intolerable bonds of the capitalist. Those millions we shall free to a life that is worthy of a man. And it will all be due to our leader, Carl Peterson.
At that moment, Durrell's voice came up from the hall. A whole bunch are stowed away, Hugh. What's the next item?
Hugh walked to the top of the stairs. As he went down, he cried over his shoulder.
Bring them both below.
A grin spread over his face as he saw half a dozen familiar faces in the hall, and he hailed them cheerily.
Like old times, boys. Where's the driver of the lorry?
That's me, sir. One of the men stepped forward. My mate's outside.
Good, said Hugh. Take your bus 10 miles from here, then drop that crowd of sleeping beauties one by one on the road as you go along. Then take her back to your garage. I'll see you later. Now, we've got to set the scene for tomorrow morning.
He sat down on the foot of the stairs.
Gather round and listen to me.
For 5 minutes he spoke, and his audience nodded delightedly. Apart from their love for Drummond, and 3 out of every 4 of them knew him personally, it was a scheme which tickled them to death. And he was careful to tell them just enough of the sinister design of the master criminal to make them realise the scale of the issue. Hugh pulled the car up silently in the deep shadows of some trees, hard by Laidley Towers, and he and Toby Sinclair got out. Now, old boy, said Hugh, you take her back to the Elms.
But confound it all, said Toby Sinclair. Don't you want me to help you?
I do, by taking the buzz box back. This little show is my shout. Grumbling, Sinclair stepped back into the car, and Hugh stood watching as it disappeared. The sudden snap of a twig close by, the sharp hiss of a compressed air rifle, seemed simultaneous with Hugh hurling himself flat on his face behind a sheltering bush. In reality, there was that fraction of a second between the actions which allowed the bullet to pass harmlessly over his body, instead of finishing his career there and then. Very cautiously, he turned his head and peered about. A shrub was shaking a few yards away, and on it Hugh fixed his half-closed eyes. If he lay quite still, the man, whoever he was, would probably assume the shot had taken effect and come and investigate. For 2 minutes he saw no one. Then very slowly the branches parted and the man came out into the open. It was Peterson's chauffeur. Step by step he advanced towards the motionless figure, his weapon in readiness. But the soldier lay sprawling and inert. Contemptuously he rolled Drummond over. Then he laid his gun on the ground, preparatory to running through his victim's pockets. The fact that such an action was a little more foolish than offering a man-eating tiger a peppermint lozenge did not trouble the chauffeur. In fact, nothing troubled him again.
That was Chapter 5 of Bulldog Drummond by Herman McNeil. It was read by Julian Rind-Tutt. The producer was John Simpson, and it was abridged by Neville Teller. And